Hello.
To your levels.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can the computer hear you? That's the interesting part. That's going to be a conundrum. Will the audience be able to hear Keith?
Can you hear me, computer?
Yes.
You seem like the waveforms look like you're kind of low.
Do we need to get closer?
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe just hold it a little bit closer to your mouth hole.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, that's better. Yeah.
Hey, you. There we go.
Okay, cool. All right. Probably should have figured this out before we started recording, but you know what? Yeah. I always think it's funny for the audience to see how the sausage is made, and I am not fucking asked editing this shit out.
We'll do it live.
Do it live. That's it. That's exactly it. All right. Hey, you and welcome. My name is Mike. This is another episode, another epi-ep of the TC, that chapter pod, potty C.
Back to the pod pals.
Pod pals. Mike and Keith. Back at it again. What's new with the audience? I'm wondering. I hope they're all doing good whenever they're listening to this. Daytime, nighttime, something. You know, it's funny. I always have like ideas of shit I have to say.
Yeah.
Not when I'm recording. As soon as I start, like I turn the recorder on and I just like blank.
I know myself when I listen to podcasts. I only really listen to podcasts when I'm driving.
I listen to podcasts like 24/7.
Do
I
you?
Always, I'm one of those people, I always need something in my ears.
Okay, yeah.
So yeah. So I'm always listening to some kind of audio. Yeah.
No, I like when I'm driving. I like to feel like someone's beside me.
You're not lonely. You don't have that somebody to brush away those tears.
Yeah. I'm not going to do it myself.
Well, you know, it's been a... When was the last time we recorded?
It's been a while.
You know, let's just shoot shit. Fuck this story. Let's just talk. I'm fucking tired. I was editing videos all day. For the folks at home, we were recording this Thursday, March 28th. And I was editing the video about Ruby Frankie all day. And I'm... bollocks. So I'm not arse fucking telling another story. Fuck everybody. I'm drinking a beer. We're drinking again as well, by the way.
Finally. Mm-hmm. We've
Alcos are back in town, baby.
We haven't had drinks since before Christmas, yeah, because after Christmas you done dry January. Well, moist
wing,
January.
Wing dry, wing, yeah. Yeah.
You had a couple of slip-ups, but then after that, we didn't really drink. But,
no.
And then, the last time we done an episode was Up in the Attic, was it?
No, we recorded here.
Oh, we did. Yeah, we did.
The listener story. We got to do it again. Thank you so much to everybody who's been sending in their listener stories, by the way, since that listener app went live. I got some great stories, so thank you. We will do another one soon, I think. Recording it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, yeah. And you said you got like a pile more episode or listener stories in?
Oh, a shitload. Yeah, people are sending so many in. So yeah, thanks to everybody who sends them in. We got some great ones, I hope. I presume you aren't lying to me, everybody sending in their stories, and you're telling the absolute truth.
I don't care if they're lies. They're good reads.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not going to verify this shit. Yeah, I'm not fact-checking. actually. So please keep sending your stories in, because we will read them out if they are good. If they are bad, we will not read them out.
We might read them out. And just rip the shit out of you.
Yeah, exactly. We'll see. But I have so many to go through. So there's some great ones there. Thanks everybody who listens. We appreciate you.
We know.
Means a lot to me and Keith. Do you want to just get into this whole story?
Yeah, man. Looking forward
to it. Why not?
It's a good story.
She may as well.
Good old mystery.
People clicked on this episode because there were words in the title. We may as well get to that.
There we go.
Hey, thanks. What an intro. I'm such a pro. You know, that type of podcast is about a year old now.
Yeah, I seen that. I was looking at the YouTube channel the other day when the last one was put up. Wait, when was the first one put up?
I have no idea. No, I put it up. I started the podcast.
The last one we
like
done.
The YouTube channel I started up about a month after I started posting them. People kept asking me to put them on YouTube, so I was like, fine.
Yeah. The first one that we done together was around this time last year.
No shit.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Which one was that one?
It was the Hammersmith Ghost, I believe.
Oh, yeah, because we did record the... we recorded two.
Yeah.
That were...
We done the Rod Farrell one.
Your Rod Farrell one.
That was love.
That went up as a bonus episode.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we recorded another one. I can't remember what it was. But yeah, look at you now. Look at us now. All right. Well, here, listen, let's get into today's topic, which is if most people probably fucking switched off by now. Listen to me just drone on.
No, come back.
We're
going to get good, I swear.
Yeah, yeah. We're getting to the murders. Today, now, we're going to talk about the Setagaya family murders. Now, me and Keith, we don't often get to Japan very often. By that, I mean never. I've never been to Japan. Always wanted to go. Looks like a pretty interesting country.
Looks like a fun place. Yeah.
It does. Been to Korea.
Yeah.
Been there once before, and I'm going again in a couple
soon,
weeks.
Yeah.
Korea rocks. I've been to Busan, which is pretty close to Japan.
Okay.
It's just across the sea, whatever the sea that's called. I don't know. But it's pretty close. I think he, you know, so that's cool. That's where it's close to it.
Right, okay.
So that kind of counts.
Yeah.
All right, I've been to Japan.
You were close enough.
I'm saying, yeah, close enough means I was there. So we don't often get to talk about stories from Japan, but you know, when we do, they're always really, really messed up. The last time we did one was the monster with...
21 faces.
I was going to say 100 faces. I totally forgot what it was called. But that was a really messed up story.
It was, yeah.
I think this one is kind of more messed up, actually, because this one involves real life murders. Pretty gruesome as they get.
Yep.
A family wiped out in a flash of violence that has had authorities in Japan bamboozled for decades. What makes it stand out from most high-profile crimes is that despite the absolute mountain of evidence, and there's literally a mountain of shit included in that evidence, no names have ever been raised for extra scrutiny. Usually, when a killer is as apparently sloppy as they were in this old case, it's simply a matter of grabbing a couple of fingerprints and then, you know, driving over to nab the guy. But that's what makes this case so bizarre, is that they have so much on them, and they still, it's still an incredibly giant-ass, sumo-sized, you might say, mystery. It's really weird. It's like, it's a very frustrating case.
It is, it's great. And I find what's crazy about it is how it's gone unsolved for so long. Like, we've done some cases recently where murderers, they got away with it for years, but like thanks to DNA advancements, justice, it finally caught up with them. Unfortunately, like this is not the case here, and it's not for like lack of trying either. Even as recent as December, just gone, police in Tokyo, they were handing out flyers appealing for information, and even displayed a mannequin wearing the clothes of what they thought the killer was wearing.
That's wild.
What they believed he was wearing at the time, so they gave it a good shot.
They did, yeah. They gave it the old college try. It's wild, though. So, for the folks at home who clicked on the title, the Setagaya murders, the title Setagaya, by the way, refers to the where rather than the who, with the despicable action taking place in the... Guys, I hope you are looking forward to me butchering the shit out of some Japanese names, because I am going to. It takes place in the Kamisoshigaya neighborhood of Setagaya, which is an area in the western suburbs of Tokyo. Setagaya, it's a pretty popular area of Tokyo. It's not like the most high-end, the most exclusive. It's pretty affordable, but it's quite a nice area. So as you know, crime in Japan, it's pretty standard. Standard crime in Japan means low crime, right? So that's always the thing with Japan, is that when the crimes do take place there, they're like, you guys have been saving up.
Yeah.
You know, you guys have just combined all your like petty crimes into one big, massive, messed up crime. And that's exactly what happens here. So what should have been a day of celebrations and happy family times turned out to be an absolute horror show. Now, it's worth mentioning, too, that when Japanese people, you know, they refer to the new year, it can be a little bit different to outsiders, Westerners, with Japan only adopting the Gregorian calendar in the 1800s. So prior to that, the calendar was based on lunar cycles with dates and traditions being built around them. Though modern Japan, it's very different. There are still many remnants of the lunar cycle days left over. And the Japanese, for them, marking the new year, it's a very serious, it's a very serious thing. For them, it's much more spiritual rather than, you know, hey, let's get shit-faced and party into the night. For them, it's like, you know, it's a real somber, maybe, well, you know, a little bit more somber than we would be. Buddhist temple bell rings out 108 times in total, which is a lot of times.
I looked up why.
You did?
Yeah, I did.
Well, Keith is coming in with the facts hot and fast, ladies and gentlemen. Look at him. Why?
I did my research. Each ring represents one of 108 earthly temptations a person must overcome to achieve nirvana. So 108.
List them out.
Six represents our six senses of sight, touch, sound, taste, smell, and consciousness. Three indicates the different ways those sensations are experienced, so good, bad, or neutral. Two is the dimension of attachment to pleasure, and three represents past, present, and future. So basically that's 6 times 3 times 2 times 3, which is, you get a total of 108. Now, I don't know why they decided to multiply those numbers instead of just adding them to get like 14 that. Rings.
Okay, let's go through all 108. 1, TV. 2, sports. 3, beer. 4, tits. 5, ass. These are all of my temptations. So, as the temple, you know, the bells, they ring out on New Year's Day, kind of like that U2 song, many families, they take the time to visit a shrine or, you know, pray for good health, that kind of stuff, and, you know, to have a prosperous New Year. There's certainly no fireworks celebrations, you know, 3, 2, 1, like we do here in the West. In Japan, they usually do fireworks in the summer. It's also time for children to look forward to it for more mercenary reasons, with another long-standing tradition being children getting personalized decorated envelopes from their parents with some of that sweet, sweet yen inside. Mm, dollar, nice. Dollar bills, yeah. So kids, they receive gifts and games to play, essentially kind of like Christmas, because Christmas, it's, again, not as celebrated in Japan. It's becoming more celebrated in Japan, but not as much so. That's a lot of kids would get their presents on New Year's Day rather than, you know, 5 days earlier.
Yeah. I always found it really funny how Christmas and KFC are completely intertwined in Japan.
I've heard this before. Yeah, it's a big, huge Japanese tradition to get fried chicken Christmas Day, which rocks, by the way. Yeah, I would happily give up a Christmas dinner for a bucket of fried chicken.
I would much rather KFC.
Yeah.
One of those Zinger burgers.
Oh, absolutely. Just a bucket of chicken.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know who does really underrated chicken wings is KFC. I think their wings are severely underrated. Yeah. I love KFC chicken wings.
Whatever those, what is it, 11 spices?
Can we get KFC? I'd really love some KFC right now.
We should get some food after this, actually.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of hungry.
Yeah, yeah.
So, at the turn of the millennium, most Japanese families were breathing a sigh of relief that the dreaded bug turned out to be complete bullshit. Like a lot of the world, Japan had taken the potential threat very seriously, with the then Prime Minister, Kaiji Obuchi, even providing citizens with a checklist to go through to protect them from any possible fallout from the digital catastrophe. Do you remember that, like, when it was turning 1999 to 2000, the millennium bug or whatever it was?
The old Y2K?
Yeah, the Y2K thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I was thinking of that in my head and I just couldn't think for some reason. Like, do you remember? I remember it being the news, but I remember also not giving a shit about it.
Well, we were nine, so...
That's true.
We weren't too concerned about it.
Yeah. My stocks, you know. And then I was like, yeah. That's true. I was nine, so.
It was a good year. I specifically remember that New Year's because it was a huge celebration. And I remember I managed to sneak off, get some champagne. It was my first time having like something like alcoholic. I was like, ooh. And it was excellent. I really enjoyed it.
Look at you. So far from the relief and happiness that the Y2K bug hadn't imploded the world, the Miyazawa family, or at least what remained of it, were experiencing something very different. Around 10:30 on the final morning of the previous millennium, so this is 10:30 a.m. on, December 31st, mm-hmm. 1999. I had to think about that for a second. It's like, what year ago? The Miyazawas should have been making plans, you know, about what celebrations they were going to have that night. Cleaning out the house to disperse the last year's problems away in a cloud of dust would be a common one, right? You want to clean up so you can start off the new year, right? Those plans changed very quickly when Haruko, the mother of Yasuko Miyazawa, the family matriarch, had been unable to get in touch with her daughter. The Miyazawa family was made up of dad, Mikio, mom, Yasuko, daughter, Nina, 8 years old, and son, Rei, 6 years old. And the layout of how this family lived, it's a little bit different from how a lot of Westerners would live, because essentially there was the Miyazawa family made up of those four in one house. And then essentially the house was like kind of split in half, and the mother of Yasuko, Haruko, she lived in the other side of the house, and she lived there with her other daughter and her daughter's husband, so son-in-law. I don't know, for some reason it's a weird situation for me to get wrap my head around.
So it was kind of like a duplex or a semi-detached house. The house was weird. It was really weirdly secluded, especially for being in the heart of the city.
Right, yeah, suburb of Tokyo. But yeah, if you look at pictures around it, there was like lots of grass around it. And I think it edged onto a park.
Yeah, yeah. So sad guy, it's one of the most populous of Tokyo's 23 wards. So their house was just out on its lonesome in like, it was kind of like in the middle of the park. It was on the edge, but there was nothing too much behind them either. Basically, what happened was in the early 90s, there was 200 houses that were built along the park boundary. But over the next 10 years, due to Japan's increasing expansion, these houses, they were bought back by the city and turned into more parkland. And by the year 2000, only four of those houses remained, one of which was the home of the Miyazawa family. Yeah, and I looked it up in Google Maps and it's really creepy. It's like it's all boarded up and the house is just overlooking this playground and skate park. And it's just in the middle of this park. It's very weird.
So that New Year's Eve, grandmother Haruko couldn't get in touch with her daughter Yasuko, and so decided to pop over to the house and see, you know, if everything was okay and what was going on. And Haruko found her son-in-law's body first. She found the body of Mikio. He was a bloody mess laid at the base of the stairs on the ground floor of their house. Those stairs led to the second floor, where Haruko found 6-year-old Rei next. Unlike his father, Rei didn't look like he'd been attacked, rather like he was just asleep. Of all the Miyazawa family, he was the only one who likely had no idea his family was ever in danger. 8-year-old Nina and her mother were the last to be found. The third story of the home was taken up by a large loft space with the parents' and Nina's beds in there. Yasuko, the mother, and Nina were found at the bottom of the ladder leading up to the loft. Having been stabbed multiple times, the scene was so bloody and savage that it's unlikely Haruko will ever be able to forget the image of her daughter and her daughter's family.
There was also like blood spatter found up in the third story loft.
Wow.
So it's like it's possible that the attack on Yasuko and Nina started up there where they were essentially trapped.
It
was basically like an attic converted. But it ended up at the bottom of the ladder, as you mentioned, so horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty grim. And Haruko was so shocked she couldn't believe what she was seeing. She had to touch her daughter and granddaughter, partly just to see if they were really, truly beyond any help, but largely also just to force her mind to accept what she was seeing, you know, that was reality. Almost catatonic, Haruko managed to gather herself enough to return next door and to call the police. A steady stream of uniformed officers from every corner of Tokyo followed, steadily flooding the area, with many who went inside the Miyazawa home needing counseling and time off work to deal with the impact of what they saw and had to work with that morning. With the emergency services came the news, seems, and rumors of what exactly had happened in Setagaya, and that began to spread around Japan. And if it wasn't for the New Year's celebrations, the story likely would have drawn even more attention than it did. This was incredible, like an entire family of four butchered inside their own home. The investigation, run by Chief of Seijo Police, Takeshi Tsuchida, quickly concluded that the murders had taken place sometime in the hours between the 30th and the 31st of December, around 11:30 p.m. and just after midnight. One of the most shocking aspects released very early into the investigation was that though the family had been killed quickly, their killer, get this folks, had stuck around in the house for a long ass time, eating from the family's fridge, using Mikio's computer. In total, the investigators believe that the killer who butchered this family spent somewhere between 2 and 10 hours in the Miyazawa home. And you know what's even more frightening for the grandmother, Haruko, who discovered this, is that there's a wall separating.
Yeah.
Haruko lived with her daughter and her son-in-law, and then there's a wall, and then her whole family's butchered, and the killer was there for like 10 hours.
The whole time. Yeah. This part of the story just like sends chills down my spine.
Yeah.
Like, it even just like murdering a whole family and then spending up to 10 hours just hanging out with the bodies, making yourself at home was like fucked
up.
Oh
man, but yeah, we'll get into what he was doing. And he was doing a lot.
He did. And he really did make himself at home. One of the things that the police noted about the crime scene was how much of an absolute mess it was. And I'm not just talking about like the bodies or the blood. The murderer had a really good rummage through all of the Miyazawa's stuff, like pulling out nearly every single drawer in the house and dumping it out. So there was just papers and stuff everywhere. It was kind of like a burglary, except nothing was taken.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, stuff was actually left. But
we'll get into that. He was dropping loads, all right, that's for sure. By the way, it's Mikio's computer that gives us the kind of window for when the murders took place. At 10:38 p.m. on December 30th, 1999, Mikio used the password to open a work email, and then Yasuko's mother, Haruko, discovered the scene at 10:40 a.m. on the 31st of December. So we kind of know this because Mikio's computer mouse was moved by Haruko registering movement, and it's kind of, you know, giving us that window of when things would have happened. So during these several hours the killer spent inside the Miyazawa's home, police suspect that they not only took a nap after tending to their wounds, which we'll get to, but they know that the killer ate 4 ice cream bars from the family fridge and even tried to buy a ticket to a concert with Mikio's bank, which, wow. What was it? I wonder who the concert was. Who's saying? This was likely a way of checking if he could use the card, as the concert in question was a page that Mikio had previously visited. The Miyazawa family home backed onto Soshigaya Park, and authorities believe that the killer, or killers, had used a tree that conveniently provided them with an easy entry right into the Miyazawa's second floor bathroom. After climbing the tree, across the branches, all that stood between the killer and the house was a flimsy screen over the window, which was easily and quietly removed, and that's how the killer gained entry. As Keith said, you know, the area around the Miyazawa home, it's pretty barren of residents. There's only 3 families still living in the area when the murders took place. And this was due to the park surrounding them being hugely expanded and enveloping the surrounding homes. Now, that doesn't mean it wasn't a busy area, though. There was a nearby skate park that drew, you know, a lot of visitors, particularly young teens, every single day. In fact, many think it could have been an argument between Mikio and one of these teens that sparked the entire saga, but again, we'll get to suspects and what we believe could have happened. See, on the day leading up to the killings, Mikio had apparently confronted a group of skaters over them being too loud, which led to an argument that almost got physical. He'd apparently done this before with a group of bikers, so it seems clear that Mikio, he wouldn't get pushed around. If somebody's pissing him off, he'd let him know. But anyway, we'll get to the suspects and stuff like that later. So, the killer gained entry by climbing a tree and then removing the screen that covered the window. The youngest of the Miyazawa family, 6-year-old Rei, was first to be killed. Unlike the rest of the family, Rei was strangled to death. The killer was likely trying to be sneaky and not alert the rest of the family who were spread throughout the home. Something, however, didn't go to plan. At least Ray's father, Mikio, heard the disturbance coming from his son's room and went to see what the noise was and what the disturbance was. What happened next, though, we can't be sure, but the scene indicates that there had been a furious fight between the intruder and 44-year-old Mikio, with Mikio unknowingly fighting for his and his family's survival. Unfortunately, despite evidence showing that Mikio had given everything he could, even managing to injure the attacker, in the end he was unable to fend off his son's killer. The fight ended as brutally and suddenly as it started, with Mikio being stabbed in the head. The fatal wound, it was made by a sashimi knife the killer had brought with them. It was so violent it snapped the blade, leaving the tip embedded in Mikio's skull. Though the head wound was more than enough to kill him on his own, that wasn't the end of the onslaught, and Mikio was continuously stabbed again and again, well after he stopped being any kind of threat to this intruder. Whoever it was that entered the Miyazawa home that night had a desire to kill and was not going to let anything get in their way.
One of the reasons that police were able to determine that the murders took place at 11:30 was because Yuzuka's mother, sister and brother-in-law, who lived, as I said, next door, said that they'd heard a notable thud at around 11:30 p.m. Mm. And the police, they theorised that this thud might have been the moment when Mikio confronted the attacker.
Yeah.
Which is, like, that's just absolutely horrible. Knowing that, like, you heard the moment that the family was being attacked.
Yeah.
Like, they all like, heard it, but just kind of, you know, pounded off. It's like, they're just moving something or making noise or didn't think much of it.
Yeah. What was that noise? Oh, I don't know. Okay, moving on.
And just kept watching TV. Then. Actually, and that was one of the reasons they were able to kind of, they were said, did you hear anything? Like, yeah, we heard a thud. And they were like, oh, well, what were you watching at the time? So they said what they were watching. They checked the TV guide and that's how they were able to get like
11:30. Exactly. So you can get a good old TV guide. I know. Very good. So even after the frenzy of violence they'd inflicted on Mikio, the killer's appetite for creating bloody chaos was not satisfied, and the worst of their savagery was still being held back, but not for long. So with the husband and youngest child dead, there was nothing between 41-year-old Yasuko, 8-year-old Nina, and a psychotic killer except a flight of stairs. By the time Yasuko laid eyes on whoever this killer was, the time for running was already gone. Even in the face of the extreme level of violence already inflicted on her husband, the attack on Yasuko and Nina was astonishingly cruel. The two female members of the household were first attacked with the broken sashimi knife that had killed Mikio, then the killer switched to a santoku knife from the kitchen and continued to slash and stab at the mother and daughter's bodies, continued to do so long after they were both dead.
One horrifyingly sad detail that came out of the autopsy was that 8-year-old Nina, she tried to fight her attacker off, but she was beaten so badly that a number of her teeth were broken and her brain started to bleed inside of her skull. And the autopsy, it also showed that the knife attacks on both Yasuko and Nina continued well after they were both dead. So the killer, he was just in this rage-fueled frenzy when he got to the women. So
yeah,
that was one of the theories that, like, maybe he just like hates women, you know, because he killed the son, he killed the father, but this, when he got to the women, was just like absolute rage.
So one of the very first points of investigation in any case like this is to check for stolen items, as more often than not, it's a robbery or robbery gone wrong that turns out to be the primary motive for such instance. Like, you already mentioned, though, that nothing was stolen. And you're absolutely right. You know, the killer breaking in looking for shit to steal was ruled out almost immediately. Now, Mikio kept a large amount of money in his study, around 150,000 yen, which is about, let's say, it's about $1,000, plus another 5,000 yen in various currencies. There's no way that a robber, even in this case of a robbery gone terribly wrong, would not have taken that money with them. In fact, the only thing the killer did take was one of Mikio's old jackets, which we will get to. Mikio, he worked for Interbrand. That's his company. And you've likely never heard of them, but you've definitely been affected by Interbrand. They are the advertising company responsible for inventing the term Wi-Fi.
There you go.
Look at you.
My Wi-Fi.
My Wi-Fi. Yeah, that's good. I like that a lot. I couldn't find out exactly what Mikio did at the agency, but it's safe to say his work wasn't the kind that would have put him in a position to piss off someone so badly that they'd want to wipe out his entire family. In fact, even in the personal lives of both Mikio and Yasuko, they were basically both described as the type of people who just didn't make enemies, which usually makes for a steady life, but in this case it just meant there was a serious lack of suspects for the police to look at. The idea of the intended victims maybe having, you know, being previous residents, that was also ruled out, you know, maybe a case of mistaken identity, and it was like, no, they had lived here for almost 10 years, they'd moved into the property in 1990, so they were the targets even if the killer didn't know who they were. So one bizarre but intriguing line of inquiry involves the nearby skate park and a few young punks who frequented the area. As I said, I've already mentioned this, allegedly in the build-up to the murders, Mikio had a few stern words with a group of young rapscallions who'd make a noise and generally just bothering the family, you know.
You darn kids!
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't anything too serious, but it was enough that it stood out to people. You know, people remembered it happening, and if this family was just brutally murdered, it was worth mentioning. After all, the vague suspect the police had outlined was seemingly a quote-unquote skater type.
Real cool.
A cool ass dude. 100%. Yeah, sure. He listens to Blink-182 and all. He's a real Avril Lavigne type guy. You know what I'm saying? Real skater boy. The suspect's shirt. It's a real head scratcher. It's another piece of evidence that usually you'd expect to be reading in, that's how they got them, you know, but no. Far from that ideal, however, is the shirt has become yet another frustrating piece of evidence in a case loaded with a lot of frustrating pieces of evidence. The killer, by the way, his shirt was like a raglan type shirt, you know, baseball type shirt. This is where the case gets friggin' bizarre, is because we know the killer's shirt because he left it behind. The killer, as we already mentioned at the top, spent so long in the house, it's actually unreal. He left so much shit in the house, and we don't know who the killer is.
Yeah.
This is the most batshit case, one of the most batshit cases I think I've ever heard.
There's so much DNA, so much evidence.
It's like, how has this not been solved?
Yeah.
It's beyond belief. The reason we know so much about the shirt is because the killer literally left it behind in the house where he committed the murders, along with a whole bunch of other items, including more clothing that they'd been wearing prior to and during the attacks on the Miyazawas. The most likely reason for ditching the clothing would have been because it was bloody and would have given them away. But the t-shirt, the raglan-style t-shirt that the killer was wearing, had very little obvious blood in it, and the killer had also left behind a grey crusher hat and other items that had no blood on them at all. It was as if they'd left items behind on purpose back in the house. The white and blue raglan top actually got investigators quite excited at first, as it would. It turned out to be quite a rare item for something seemingly so pedestrian. It was discovered that only 130 units of that specific top were ever sold, and it was only available for sale from Marufuru shops, which is a chain store, and likely the same place the killer bought the gloves and hat they had also left behind.
They left everything.
I know, yeah. Did they walk into this house naked? You know?
So the old mass murder and forget your clothes mistake. Yeah. Classic.
Despite an extensive flyer campaign featuring the outfit and emphasizing the rarity of that shirt as well as the limited places it was sold, only 12 of the shirts were ever tracked down and their owners were cleared. Of all the items the killer left behind, one of the most revealing was a hip bag, or a large bum bag. Now, it wasn't so much the bag itself, though that was keeping in, it was a very, you know, skatery thing, but what was inside and on the bag that gave the police so many clues, again, it's almost as if the murderer was trying to get caught. So, in addition to a cologne called Drakkar Noir. Wow.
Drakkar Noir.
That's my Drakkar Noir.
We literally know what the killer smelled like. There was also a piece of skateboard grip tape, giving, again, more credence to the skater theory. Even more details came from a surprising source, because at the bottom of the bag was sand residue. Sand can be a gold mine for forensic investigators. There's a shocking amount of information that can be gleaned from studying it, because essentially it's very easy to identify sand and where it's been and where it's come from. So therefore, you know where the killer has been and come from.
Ah, yes. He liked the beach.
Yeah. Got him.
It's a clue.
In this case, the sand that was found in the killer's bum bag that he had left behind could be tracked all the way to its origins in southwestern USA. Specifically,
that's wild.
It's insane. Specifically, the investigators narrowed the location down to somewhere in the region of the Edwards Air Force Base, which is a military base 100 miles from LA. This revelation has led many to believe that the killer was maybe an airman or the child of someone serving in the military, but they could equally be a contractor. In fact, the military angle, I think, is, we're already touching it more later, but I think probably the most likely scenario who the killer would be, somebody related to a military brat, perhaps, you know? Because there's a lot of military bases in Japan, in Tokyo, and also in Korea, which we will also be touching on.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. The killer's shoes were not left behind, but were easily identified through prints left in blood at the scene. The shoes were Slazenger tennis shoes, which were widely available around the country. But not only did the size of the shoe not match up to, you know, anyone in the Miyazawa clan, but that particular size of shoe wasn't ever sold in Japan. Actually, this is a fun fact. So, I haven't been to Japan, I've been to Korea. Mm-hmm. But
we've established it's the same thing.
we already established. I was in Busan, which is basically Japan. I did actually have to buy a pair of shoes in Busan, and they don't do big sizes.
Really?
I think they had very, like, I'm not a big shoe size, I think I'm like a 10, 10 and a half.
Yeah.
And I was like, they had one, and nothing above that.
That's wild.
Yeah.
It's just like the populations have small feet.
Most populations just have smaller feet than we do. Yeah. So like 10 and a half is like big feet for them.
That's bad.
Couldn't believe me. I know. They kept calling me names in Korean. I was very upset. I left crying.
Bigfoot.
Yeah. In fact, the sizing of the shoe, or rather the imprint of the shoe, was specific to South Korea. Once again, indicating that the killer was either said Korean or had visited Korea very recently. One really interesting fact that the clothing left behind revealed was that the items had all been washed in hard water. Now, Japan uses a soft water system, so whatever clothing had been washed, it hadn't been washed in Japan. Well, that's a batshit thing that they could actually tell.
Yeah, yeah.
The most likely culprit, again, would be South Korea. Hard water. Again, if the perpetrator was from a military family, this would make sense as they would have moved from base to base to base. And as we've already mentioned, a lot of American military bases, specifically in both South Korea and Japan. Driving down the streets in Seoul one day, you'd see American trucks, like U.S. military.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually seen quite a few, like a surprising few.
Yeah, yeah.
It was quite interesting.
That's mad. Yeah.
The killer also left behind a black AirTech jacket, a pair of black gloves, as we mentioned already, a scarf, and a black handkerchief. What did they take with? Well, they took Mikio's jacket, but seriously, they left so much behind, it's wild.
Like they definitely would have been better out, like, putting up, look for a nude man.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. The sheer amount of items left behind meant the police were able to even put out an image of a mannequin dressed in exactly what the killer was wearing. Of course, what they left wearing is a different matter, not something we can be entirely sure of, but we do know that one of Mikio's jackets was missing. The handkerchief was found to have the same cologne, Drakkar Noir.
This stuff is Drakkar Noir, man!
As found on the hip bag. While the very idea of the handkerchief indicated that actually the police were looking for someone older, usually older people are the ones who have handkerchiefs, not many skate punks really use them, especially ironed ones, as this one was, it's very possible, again, that the killer was from a military family. Maybe it was a parent who ironed the hanky and insisted their little angel carried it. Either way, what should have been a revealing clue seems to have just served to obfuscate the truth even more, with all sorts of conclusions being reached.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. I'm not sure if the killer was actually one of the skater kids from the park. So when they appealed to the public for information, reports did come in of a man dressed in skater attire at a train station near the Miyazawa's house on the 29th of December. This man, he drew attention because he was noticeably underdressed for the weather. Like, it was winter and he had like a raglan shirt on. On the same day, a man fitting the same description was believed to have purchased this sashimi knife in a nearby supermarket. Then on December 30th, a man, once again fitting the same description, was spotted near Sengawa Station, closer to the Miyazawa's home. However, it was estimated that this person was between 35 and 40 years old. So it seems that it was an older man dressed in teenager clothing. I don't know, possibly trying to cling on to his youth. Yeah, something I wouldn't know kids, about. Yeah. I wouldn't have known about that.
Konnichiwa, fellow kids.
Yeah, literally. But what's interesting, though, is that in the months prior to the murders on New Year's Eve, there was a number of reports of animal abuse that had occurred in the park. In August, neighbours found a brown cat with its tail cut off with a box cutter. Then, a few days after this incident, another cat was found with a nail stuck in its eye.
Oh my god.
As far as I can tell, both of these cats survived. However, in mid-December, a cat was found half-skinned alive.
Oh.
It believes it was done with a kitchen knife or scissors that was used. The cat, he was brought into the vet, but unfortunately he died the next day. It just seems too coincidental that a string of, you know, pretty disturbing incidents of animal abuse happened in the exact same area right before the murders, not to be connected in any way. So it kind of seems like
that's usual dead giveaway, right?
Right. Yeah. Like, it definitely seems like the murderer, he was a frequent visitor to the park, at least.
I mean, the whole thing about the skater boy thing, I was just thinking, it's like in 1999, 2000, like everybody, like that was the style.
Yeah.
Back in the day, like, it's not like nowadays skater style isn't as popular.
Yeah.
But in the early 2000s, like, everybody dressed like skaters. Lots of non-skaters dressed like skaters with the baggy jeans and shit like that, and the belts and the black. It's like, skater was like...
It was big.
It was big. Everybody dressed. I think I probably dressed like that, or to some extent, and you probably did too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I definitely did.
Yeah.
I could not skate. I tried my best, but I couldn't do it.
Yeah, me neither. I was not very good at it. So thanks to the killer's mortal combat with Mikio, they had sustained more than one cut themselves, leaving their own... The killer's own blood was in the house. Much of it was found on the Miyazawa's first aid kit, as well as some on Yusuko's sanitary towels, which police think the killer, you know, used as makeshift bandages. The blood it left behind didn't quite give investigators the detailed information that it would today. DNA testing back then still in its infancy at the turn of the last millennium. But this also gave police another tread to follow. Not the blood itself, but the injury that led to it being splashed across the Miyazawa's house. A check of the local hospitals actually did turn up something that stuck out in the medics' minds. On the afternoon of December 31st, 2000, just hours after the scene had been discovered, a man, thought to be in his 30s, was admitted to a medical center in Tobu Nikko. The Tobu Nikko Medical Center, just a few hours away from Setagaya, could have easily been reached at that time by the killer. There are even trains running directly between the two areas. Unfortunately, despite the injury to the man's hand being so severe that his bones were exposed and it required several stitches, the man did not give his name at any time during treatment, and he was released without any ID being recorded. It's kind of unthinkable that in this day and age that such a thing would be possible, but at the time, I suppose it was. Apparently, the only reason the staff remembered the man was because of his completely flat affect, barely reacting despite the severity of the injury. Of all the evidence left behind, one piece stood out from the rest, both in its level of seriously gross and seriously revealing. So apart from all the fingerprints, clothing, and blood, the killer had left investigators with a... nice little surprise, in the upstairs bathroom of the Miyazawa's home, which was a big old poo.
There's no nice way to say it.
Yeah, there's no good way of saying it. I was struggling there, but nothing. Again, this meant more evidence for investigators to test for biological information, but the very fact that he took a poo where he just brutally murdered four people seems kind of wild.
It kind of shows how relaxed he was.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know about you, but like, in high-tense situations.
I'm going to clench up.
Yeah, I need time, I need space.
Yeah. Analysis discovered the remains of what was a basic dish. It contained sesame, spinach, string beans, and a lot of comments online, especially from Asian nationals, called the dish dull and boring. And many were keen to point out that... whatever he had probably last eaten, it was something a mother would make for her grown-up son living at home but still eating his mama's cooking. Up to today, more than 240,000 investigators collected and collated more than 12,500 individual pieces of evidence. Not only do we have a detailed description of what the killer was wearing and what they likely looked like, even though what the person responsible smelled like and what they had eaten before committing the murders. Authorities have their blood and their fingerprints. And there is a 20 million yen reward waiting for anyone with information that leads to a conviction. And all of that, literally, you would think they have every single thing. no suspect at all, let alone anybody named, taken into custody, anything like that.
Crazy. And
it's wild.
Like in Japan as well, they can compel DNA samples from people suspected of committing lesser offenses. So this means that they have a pretty robust DNA database, mm-hmm. almost 1.3 million in the police database systems as of August 2020. So for the killer's DNA not to be in the system would likely mean that it was either the first offense and they got away with it, or they're not from Japan, as we're
Yeah, that's the likely thing, right, is that the DNA, they were able to find, I can't exactly remember, but it was like, it was an Asian person who did it, they could tell from the DNA. The genealogical DNA, and I think it was like most likely a Korean national or person of Korean descent, which would match up with how the thing was, how their clothes were washed, the shoe size, the military bases thing, which I think is probably most likely then, for sure. That it was somebody, it was a person on holiday who just decided to murder a family. On holiday, but just, you know, someone who moved around the world a lot.
Yeah, that's it. Like, they seem to be like with the DNA and also if they seem to be getting closer to who it was, where it's from, but it's still like, why though?
Yeah.
Why did they do it?
Yeah.
It's so weird. It's bizarre.
Yeah. I know, it's like serial.
There was no monetary gain. There was nothing to get from it. It was just madness.
Yeah. But the fact is as well, if it's like just somebody just randomly wanted to kill, it was so gruesome and they stayed in the house for so long, you think they probably killed again or before.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, with just how calm it seemingly they were. Calm enough to take a poop beside like four dead bodies.
And then eat a bunch of ice cream.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's wild. So yeah, they still do not know who did this. The case has had many in Japan supporting an indefinite extension to the country's statute of limitations regarding violent crimes, especially murder. And this was largely the case that got protesters what they wanted, with Japan abolishing the statute in 2010. So no matter how much time passes, there is still a chance that one day someone may still be held accountable for this heinous crime. With every day that passes, though, that chance becomes more and more unlikely. But again, authorities are still receiving hundreds of tips every year, as you said at the start. Even just December just gone.
Yeah.
They're still pushing.
Still there looking, yeah. What was it? You said 240,000 investigators have been on this.
Passed through this over the, you know, 24 years it's been.
That's an insane amount of people.
And there's still more than a couple of dozen officers whose full-time job it is to review and analyze each and every piece of evidence in the Miyazawa murders. On top of that, every year, members of the Tokyo Metropolitan Police, both retired and active, make a pilgrimage of sorts to the Miyazawa house in Setagaya to leave cards, flowers, offer their prayers for the case's resolution and justice for the family. But that is the end of the Setagaya murders. It's wild. I feel like we know more about the Velasca.
Yeah.
You know, family axe murders that happened over 100 years ago or whatever it is, than we do about a murder.
With like no evidence.
With no evidence. This has every single piece of evidence you could ever want. It only happened 25, 24 years ago.
Yeah.
And they've nothing.
Yeah.
It's wild.
It doesn't make any sense. It's crazy.
There's zero suspects, zero even theories about who the suspect could be.
That's it. They've never had one suspect.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. It's so wild.
It doesn't make any sense.
No, it does not. But there you go. All right, that's the end of that one. Keith, what do you got to say about that?
So either the killer, he didn't give a shit.
Hey, but he did, I think.
And somehow he got away with it, despite being like incredibly sloppy. I've just said, like, he left everything there. Or maybe he was a genius and contaminated the scene with like a buttload of red herring evidence, which threw off investigators enough to get away with it. It'd be a good way to do it. Just kind of throwing random stuff like sand, blood, poo, everything. Just like clothes, draw it all in, and you're kind of following up like leads that lead nowhere.
That's a good theory. I like that, actually, one, because that's a kind of thing that makes sense for why he left so much literal shit behind. I like that. Leave that red herrings. Maybe he's never been to America, maybe he's never been to Korea. But then again, leaving poop behind,
maybe it wasn't his poop.
good point. Yeah. Going collecting poop. You never know. All right.
Sick bastard.
Exactly. Poop is too far.
Super.
All right. Thank you so much for listening. It means a lot to me and Keith. I hope you enjoyed this whole episode of the That Chapter podcast. New episodes out are every single the first day of the week. All right. Should we leave it there?
Yeah, sounds good. Sounds like a good place to leave it.
Cool. All right. Thanks.
See you.
All right. Bye.